Good morning. Can you take your seats, please? Good morning. Thank you. We're going to get started. Good trick. This is American Values, so we need every minute to learn what we didn't learn growing up about American values and to learn from our esteemed panel. My name is Elizabeth Baker Keffer, and I'm Chief Marketing Officer with Atlantic Media Company, parent group of The Atlantic and of National Journal, and happy to welcome you all here and to introduce Gwen Ifill, our moderator for today. Gwen, as all of you know, I hope, is the moderator and the managing editor of Washington Week, which is the longest-running public affairs program on PBS. Gwen has been in that chair since 1999. She was on the show prior to that, and before becoming the moderator of Washington Week, she spent 5 years at NBC News as the chief congressional and political correspondent, and before that covered the White House and politics for the New York Times. So she'll be moderating our panel today on American values, and happy to have her and our panel and you all with us. Thank you.
Thank you, Elizabeth. Thank you. Can you hear me? One, two, three, four. Well, I'll shout until it starts working. How's that? One of the interesting things about this panel is the title is American Values, and that can be anything you want it to be. And so I've left a purposely wide open net for our panelists, and we are fortunate, as I told them, in that we're bringing up the rear on what's been a very interesting week, so they can go in any kind of direction they want. And we have representatives here from politics, from media, and from the thought world, which I guess is what I'm calling you, Stephen Carter. Margaret Carlson, Senator Ken Salazar, Stephen Carter, Carl Cannon, Doug Schoen. Now, they each bring to this a little bit different than what you might bring to it, and that's why we're going to be interested in your questions as well. But as I've been thinking this through, I've realized that the words American values could mean so much to everybody. We live in a world now where when we talk about values, it's loaded. It could mean freedom. It could mean justice, apple pie, the American way. It can mean, in my business, comforting the afflicted and afflicting the comfortable. It can mean a belief in a higher power. It can mean that all of these values should be private, or some of these values should be public. And that's where we leap off today. Yesterday, we did a program of Washington Week from here, and a woman in the audience during the Q&A stood up and said, how do we keep religion out of public life? Not whether we should, but how should we do it? And I was quite taken by her phrasing, because her presumption was that there was no place, and in fact, it was a threat for this to happen. And it reminded me of a speech which our panelists are familiar with, which we're going to use as a leaping off point. On June 28th, Senator Barack Obama gave a speech in Washington in which he talked about the role for religion in the public square. Among the other things he talked about was the values conversation that he believes the Democratic Party has avoided because the Republican Party has co-opted the discourse, as he put it. He said when that conversation does come up about religion in the public square, it's often used as a weapon. And he says, however, he finds that Americans are looking for a phrase that caught my ear, a narrative arc in their lives. And how you decide to define that narrative arc often defines what your values are. He doesn't believe Democrats can abandon the field, and he wants to know. He told a really interesting story, which I'm a preacher's kid, so these biblical stories resonate with me. He talked about Abraham and Isaac. You'll remember the story in the Old Testament where Abraham was told to prove his fealty to God, to slay his son, take him to the top of a mountain, slay his infant son. And that at the end, God, of course, stepped in and rescued him from having to make this terrible decision. But Senator Obama raised the question, what would we have done if we walked out tomorrow and saw someone on the roof of a church getting ready to slay their child? Would we walk away because this man obviously had a vision and had decided that he knew what his vision was? Or would we call the Department of Protective Services and get the government involved in stopping this from happening because we saw morality a different way? To me, that's the perfect conflict which we all have to work through. What is the role? Is there a role? How do we put these things together? So I start with the panel by asking this question. I want you each to answer it, then we'll just throw it open to any conversation based on any ideas you have from that. Was when that woman asked me that question yesterday, Margaret, how would you have answered it? How do you keep religion out of the public square?
Well, ever since JFK had to get religion out of his race by saying that his Catholicism wouldn't interfere with what he did as president. Democrats have come to think that separation of church and state meant no religion at all. And subsequent to that, one wing of the Republican Party, I wouldn't say the Republican Party itself, but Christian fundamentalists kind of hijacked the word values and religion for themselves and defining it rather narrowly. The reaction to that, I think, led Democrats to believe that we didn't want to have any discussion of that at all because it came to be seen as an anti-gay, anti-feminist, not necessarily the golden rule that the Christian fundamentalists were pushing. And so as a consequence, Democrats, I think, kind of just left it alone and didn't have a way to talk about values or religion in public life. Clinton was able to somehow get that back, in part because he came out of the Southern tradition where there were preachers like your dad, and he knew how to talk about it. But in general, in the last election, when the pollsters found, and Doug, you can probably come up with the figures on this, that the most important thing to many voters was moral values and that the Democrats didn't have enough of them, Democrats have been looking for a way to bring that back into public life, not to keep it out of public life, as this woman suggested. And the speech by Senator Barack Obama, I thought, was brilliant in the way he traced his own journey, which so many people have, because you wonder about the meaning of life and is there a higher being and why are we here. And he talked about that in a way that was so kind of gripping and riveting and honest and true, and which I think actually defines Senator Barack Obama. I think he's gifted in ways that most politicians aren't. It's like, maybe don't try this at home, all you ordinary senators, but for him, it was really a... Yes, it was really a beautiful thing to see. And Gwen defined one person as the thought person. I like to think we're all thoughtful, and Senator Salazar, I pass it along to you, and I'm sure that you could do the same thing, and I hope that you do.
I appreciate that.
And feel free not to define this strictly as religion, even though that's the way I kick this off. You can broaden out beyond religion if you choose.
Well, the way I would answer the question that was asked of you yesterday is that I don't think we ought to. In fact, I think it's a mistake for Americans not to allow religion to come into the public square and to be very much a part of our debates. I think that when I look back at religion in my own life and then in my own political campaigns, it's been very much a part of who I am. And when I talk to my senatorial colleagues, both Republicans and Democrats, I think that for most of us who have sought to serve the public, a lot of that is rooted in our own traditions. And in my case, it's the Catholic and Christian tradition. My family founded the city of Santa Fe, New Mexico. They named it the City of Holy Faith in 1598. They, in this state, not far to the east of here, they named the mountains the Sangre de Cristo Mountains, the Blood of Christ Mountains, the San Juan Mountains. So we all come out of our own faith, whatever that faith might be. I happen to be Catholic, and I'm very proud of it. But I also think that we have seen a huge conflict in American politics and American religion and American values in terms of how we deal with this issue. And I think there's been some schizophrenia. I remember 10 days before the last election in 2004, and I remind the audience I'm the only Democrat to have won in Colorado since 1994 in any statewide election, and the only Democrat to won a U.S. Senate seat in a place where George Bush won by 5%. I was able to beat my opponent by 5% here in Colorado. But I remember 10 days before the election, I had a rally with John Kerry out in Pueblo, Colorado. And one of the things that my own church was doing is it was passing out leaflets and putting them in all the cars saying that voting for John Kerry was an absolute big mistake because of his position on choice. And we had a conversation about how we should deal with that issue. And the reality of it is that the Democrats didn't have a good way of dealing with that issue, nor did John Kerry have a good way of dealing with that issue. So coming back full circle, another quick comment. I've had an opportunity to gather the 13 Catholic Democratic senators in conversations with some of the leadership of the Catholic Church. And there is a tremendous amount of commonality between the Catholic and Christian tradition and what these 13 Catholic Democratic senators stand for. I think that dialogue is a kind of dialogue that needs to be enhanced. It needs to continue. It's not something that we ought to say shouldn't be at all a part of our dialogue or part of our discussions, either private or public. I think we need to do a lot more of that. And I guess the final point that I would make is that I fear the right wing of America and the religious zealots who have decided that they are the ones who have monopoly on the absolute truth of faith and morality. You know, I face it here in Colorado with some of the leaders of the evangelical Christian right. And, you know, I don't think that their morality is any better than mine or other Americans who don't happen to be part of that conservative religious tradition. And I think for us as Americans who believe in freedom of religion, we need to stand up against those religious right-wing conservatives that essentially are using religion to enhance their own political power purposes as well as their own organizational purposes.
Professor Carter?
Well, far would it be for me to disagree with the distinguished U.S. Senator, a distinguished member of the journalistic profession, but I have a little slightly different view about the question. As to the first question that Gwen asked, you can't get religion out of public life, and it would be a terrible mistake to try. We happen to live in the most religious nation in the Western world. People express their views according to what values are important to them. There are people who are religious in a variety of ways. There are people who are non-religious in a variety of ways. Everyone wants to participate in politics and the public life, and they should, and that's what democracy is. To say to someone, well, you're less an American because of the way you express yourself, that view, that kind of view doesn't belong in politics, is undemocratic and has no place in American politics. I thought Senator Obama's speech was a wonderful speech, and I think Senator Obama's a wonderful senator. I admire greatly. But I'm not a partisan. That is, I will confess, reasons I'll get to in a moment, probably I'm the only person up here, I'm supremely indifferent. I don't care in the least who's in the White House, who's in the Senate, who's in the Congress, because that has no effect whatsoever, none, zero, on the people that I care about most, or the black people suffering in the inner cities, and there's plenty of data to prove that, and we can talk about that later on. The problem with Senator Obama's speech is this, that although it's a wonderful speech, and I think he correctly pointed to both the problem of one side having a monopoly on the talk and of one side being afraid of the talk, on the other hand, the speech shied away too much from substance. Voters don't just sit around saying, I wish someone would say, God, I'm an idiot, I'll vote for them. That's not the way most people work. Most voters are rational. And if they gravitate in one direction or another, it is not, I want to suggest to you, because of the rhetoric. It is because of the substance. And so if you have a kind of middle-of-the-road evangelical voter, who may, like in the evangelical tradition, be, say, very suspicious of centers of secular power, whether government, big business, or anything else, who happens to be against abortion. If someone's against abortion, they're going to vote for that person without regard to whether they say God or they don't say God. In other words, the convictions that move people are going to move them in a particular direction depending on the substance and not the style of what people say. Second, we do have a lot of experience over the years with voters being told explicitly how to vote on the basis of faith. The religious left was triumphant with this in the 1960s. Read Martin Luther King's God is Marching On speech. It was Martin Luther King and not Pat Robertson who called on voters to march on the ballot box until we elect a Congress willing to, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and the rest of it is biblical quotations. That was a staple of Democratic Party organizing and a staple of Democratic Party voting for a very long time, up until the 1970s. It was not something the party shied away from. It was a crucial part of the party's base. In fact, I think it's fair to say that for most of the 20th century, the strongest religious voices in America, with minor exceptions, tended to have their greatest successes in causes on the left and their failures when they were on the right. So to the extent that we think of religion as something that shouldn't be in politics, we're really turning our back on a long progressive tradition that I value and I expect many people here value too, that in which religion was not a tool. It wasn't let's think of some language to motivate people. It was the very motive force of the people who were doing the organizing. If you look at the life of, say, an unsung hero of the civil rights movement like Fannie Lou Hamer, Fannie Lou Hamer was a Christian fundamentalist who believed that she understood precisely God's plan on earth, and because of that conviction, was able to organize sharecroppers in Mississippi, was able to nearly overthrow the all-white Mississippi Democratic Party, all driven by her fundamentalist religious conviction. So we can't just assume that these convictions lead to particular results with which one might not agree. Never try to make the enemy the conviction or the faith. Always make the enemy the cause. And as a footnote, never make the enemy the person speaking in the faith either. Last point, JFK's speech in 1960. JFK's speech is in a lot of the books as one of the great speeches of American history. I think it's a sellout. I think the 1960 speech is just terrible. It's just terrible, and I'll tell you why. It matters where he gave the speech. JFK gave the speech about, on public issues, he said very grandly, I do not speak for my church, and my church does not speak for me, and they leaped to their feet and applauded wildly, and he was giving it to a convention of Southern segregationist preachers after he won the West Virginia primary and became the likely Democratic nominee, when they were worried because he was a Roman Catholic, and in the South, the Catholic Church was the great center of Christian activism against segregation. It was the Archbishop of New Orleans who threatened to excommunicate members of the legislature who voted in favor of school segregation. The people in the South were terrified of a Catholic president who would do the church's bidding on the issue of race. When he gives that speech, that's a code word saying, don't worry, I am not going to press on the issue of race if I'm elected. And, of course, he didn't. And it's absolutely true. He absolutely didn't. It was always when the black leaders would go to the White House, in the second term we'll get to that, in the second term we'll get to that, in the second term we'll get to that. And, of course, he didn't. Now, I'm not saying he was a bad president. He did what he had to do to get elected. But I don't think we should say, we should abstract that speech from where and when it was given in discussing the proper role of religion in American life.
Thank you, Carl.
This conversation has been so interesting. I'm going to respond to this. I covered the White House for National Journal, and I think there are other contexts for Kennedy's speech, and one of them was anti-Catholicism throughout the country, not just in the South. But there's something interesting because Bill Clinton isn't the first president to be comfortable talking about Jesus Christ. All of them were. Jimmy Carter certainly was. I mean, all the modern ones. You should hear Roosevelt talk about, well, I'll get to him in a minute. But this, the issue of abortion has entered, is so toxic that it's distorted this talk on religion. John F. Kennedy had to assure the nation he wouldn't follow Catholic teaching. John Kerry was asked to do the opposite, that he would follow the Catholic bishops. And this is where he went afoul. Why? Over this one issue, abortion. It is the issue that has changed and really perverted this discussion over religion in our country. Mike Gerson, most of you know who he is. He was George W. Bush's chief speechwriter, evangelical Christian. Everybody loves him. He's a very decent person. I called up E.J. Dionne to get a nasty quote, and he said, you can't get a nasty quote on him from me or anybody else. And I didn't. He's just left the White House. But Gerson, the first candidate that he worked for was Jimmy Carter. He was in high school, and he rode his bike downtown St. Louis and passed out flyers. And that's 76. By 1980, he's working for Ronald Reagan. He is a volunteer. He's in college. What's the issue? The issue is abortion. This issue has changed American politics in a way that it's hard to overestimate. And this issue of religion, it has gotten us away from our roots. Stephen Carter is absolutely right. And I would even, about God talk on the left. In fact, what I cover, presidents, they all talk this way. Bill Clinton mentioned Jesus Christ much more than George W. Bush did. And in fact, by any objective standard, George W. Bush is the most ecumenical president we've ever had. There's simply no, if you're being fair, just look at the facts. He says, you know, synagogues, mosques, and churches every time. Now, his dad did that once in a while. Bill Clinton did it most of the time. Every time. All three. And he's the only president who's actually volunteered his view that atheists can be just as patriotic as Christians. Now, this is Woodrow Wilson spoke to that specifically and said it wasn't true. So this is not a new tradition of reaching out to non-believers. And so if we want to talk about the current, I guess Senator, I'm not as worried as you are because we've had worse times. But These presidents talk about God because Americans think about God, and they especially talk about God in times of war. And I'm not going to monopolize, Gwen. I was going to talk about that, but let me just lay this one thing, and then I'll turn it over to a guy who actually knows something about politics. George W. Bush has this phrase he uses. He's used in a State of the Union address. I've heard him say it 15 or 20 times, and he says, "Freedom is not America's gift to the world." You've all heard it. You could finish it. "It's God's gift to every man and woman in the world." Now, my liberal secular friends, and I've run into several of them up here in Aspen, when they hear that, if they hear that away, I don't hear it. They think he's got one foot in the New Testament, you know, and the other on a banana peel. That's what they hear. But that's not what I hear. I think he has both feet planted firmly in the Declaration. I think that is a very modern expression of natural rights. I don't think it's Christian fundamentalism or evangelism. Bush apparently has a deep faith. But I think what he's saying is that these freedoms that we have, that everybody has them, and that if Jefferson's right that those rights are self-evident and inalienable, the corollary in philosophy would be that the yearning for them is universal. And this is what, if it comes back to me, I'll talk. That's what I was going to talk about, and I'll talk about that more. But all presidents have faced this, including this one. And the reason they invoke God is because going to war is such a profound and awesome thing. Think about it for us, but think about it for Commander-in-Chief, the guy who orders them into office, into battle. John Quincy Adams called it the terrible sublime. He was thinking of the Civil War 30 years before. And that's what it is when brother fights against brother, the terrible sublime. And all presidents think this. And the reason they invoke God is because we're thinking of God at these times, because we want some guidance. I'll leave it there.
Well, let me try to...
Doug, you'll tell us whether anybody knows what they're talking
about. Well, I was going to say, as a practical political consultant, let me try to do two things. Let me try to answer questions in ways that I think are responsive to what Ken was talking about, real electoral campaigns and votes. And I'll begin with Margaret's question, because I think it's an important one. And it's one that hasn't been fully resolved, given when the question that you were asked. It is absolutely clear to me that the issue of morality, values, is one that the Republicans address. And they address it in a way that I find inimical to my interests and my core concerns. But also, I think the fact that the Democrats have failed to address values suggests that what the polls picked up tentatively and preliminarily, with about 20 or 21% saying they were voting on so-called morality or values issues, is a huge and important finding that is, frankly, critical to our Democratic success in 2006 and 2008. I think it does go beyond just abortion. And I think that the question is not so much, are you pro-choice or anti-choice, but how do you think about the issue of abstinence for teenagers? How do you think about the issue of educating your kids to try to know about making intelligent choices? Gay marriage is obviously part of it. But I think there are a range of substantive values-based issues that Democrats stay away from, don't talk about, are afraid of, and ultimately cedes the field to people who just are negative and do what I think the vast majority of the people in this room would consider to be unfortunate. So that's I think, point one. Point two is I think the language that everybody on the panel has spoken to is critically important as a practical political consultant, because if you speak in values terms, responsibility, obligation, the terms that you were speaking of, and they can be across the board, people hear you. They understand. If you just talk in terms of five-point plans, you will turn off the swing voter that Ken Salazar was talking about. They will not hear you. They want to be addressed in the terms they think about, because as much as we think in, you know, let's talk education today, well, we'll talk, foreign policy tonight, people's concerns typically are an amalgam of issues that address their health care, their housing, their children, and they think in values terms. What's right? How do I be a responsible person? What's going to be good for my community? So when politicians talk in values terms or religious terms, they are heard. And I would argue that that language that President Clinton used and reintroduced, and my partner Mark Penn certainly played a central role in getting the president to do it in 95 and 96, helped the Democrats in the mid to late 90s be heard. And I guess another point that I'd make, and where I'd perhaps have some small disagreement with Professor Carter. I do think it matters to people in the inner city if there's a Democrat or Republican. And I think most African-American elected officials feel that way, and I think even more important than that, African-American voters feel. But there's a reason why I pick on that issue in the context, or that question in the context of this discussion. Because African-American voters are the ones who are most oriented to the so-called values issues. And if we are ever going to build the kind of political coalitions that certainly I'd like to see restored, and I think, again, many people here would like to see restored, we have to find ways to link working-class African-Americans and whites on, for common purposes. And to my way of thinking, yes, it's partially economic, but to a very large part, it is values-based. And I think we can justify things like a minimum wage, which I think will make an enormous difference to people's lives if we talk in terms of the values of hard work, playing by the rules, giving a chance to get ahead. So I think that that does matter. And, I met Aaron Henry once, and I think he and Fannie Lou Hamer were putting their lives on the line because they shared that view and that approach to life. Certainly one that I share and think still has resonance today. Thank you.
I want to pick up on that point because it was the same thing that caught my ear, too, and I would like to have the rest of the panel respond to it. Two quick things. You have to understand that I first learned about politics in the church. I didn't understand there was a distinction between politics and religion growing up. I thought that that's the way it worked. And my first exposure to that on the presidential campaign trail was covering, of course, I'm going to date myself here. Okay, fine. covering Pat Robertson and Jesse Jackson, who were both running for president in 1988. And I remember going into it thinking I was going to see a very different kind of crowd, that the people who came out to hear these two wildly different preachers, one conservative and one liberal, were going to be very different kinds of people. Well, even though the candidates were very different kinds of people, the people who came to their audience hear them, which just take race aside for a moment, were very, very much alike. They were interested in hearing people talk about the things that concerned them. They were interested in hearing people talk about their values and their lives. And both of these candidates, in slightly different, drastically different in some cases ways, were doing that. So you're speaking to these people who are hungry for this. At the same time, Stephen Carter says that the people who most need and theoretically could most benefit from government programs, you can argue this point if you want, don't care, and it couldn't do them the least bit of good.
Oh, I said, I know.
What?
I didn't say that.
Zero. No, you clarify your point. No, before we go on. I don't want to misquote you.
I said that I don't think it'll make a difference in most of their lives. And when we get back to me, I'll explain what
okay.
I mean.
I think it would have made a huge difference if last week the Congress had passed an increase in the minimum wage.
Exactly.
I mean, the best family value is a job that pays a decent wage. And the person who came to deliver the linens at my room this morning when I was looking over some stuff, he makes $5.75 an hour.
Probably one of those undocumented workers that there's a group of Democrats, mostly Democrats, and some Republicans trying to deal with.
Right.
Get that back to some values and moral issues, Gwen.
They're getting paid $4 an hour, of course. So, but Democrats need to, right, we're in a different economy here, the Aspen economy. You know, he has two kids. If you're making $10,000 a year, you're having a hard time doing anything else but just slogging along. And I can't imagine that, Professor Carter, that African-Americans don't care about a Congress that's not working to raise the exemption for the estate tax instead of voting for an increase in the minimum wage.
Let me just jump in. I very much disagree with you, Professor Carter, on the notion that it doesn't make a difference as to who you have in these positions of power. And I see it with respect to what kind of money we're putting into Head Start programs to give kids a chance, what kind of opportunities we're giving to people who are of all backgrounds and all income backgrounds to get into higher education by the reduction in Pell Grants and Perkins Grant programs. So it does make a huge difference. And I do think that one of the values that has always made me proud to be an American, the value that I think I rested most on in terms of my own successes in public life and my own work in the Senate, is that America is truly a place of opportunity for all people, regardless of their background, regardless of their religion, regardless of their economic circumstance. And I truly believe that what this administration and the Republican leadership, because of their fiscal policies, has been doing is taking opportunity away from the common man. And I think that that is, in fact, a moral issue. I want to make just one other comment, Gwen, and that is I agree with some of the comments here about having to get deeper into the issues. And I think that it has been a fundamental mistake that many politicians, especially Democrats, have made, is in shying away from some of the substantive issues. You know, the issue of abortion is not a an issue that can be cavalierly dismissed for any person that has to face that issue personally, or any person who has to deal with that issue as a legal or a policy matter. It seems to me that it is a very, very serious question,
but Senator,
that requires the American people to go into some kind of a civil dialogue so that we can talk about the issue instead of having just the polarization that we currently have over that particular issue.
But, Senator, if Doug Shone is right, how did abortion, of all things, become the doppelganger issue for every other values debate in this country?
You know, I think it became that debate because I think that Karl Rove, you can ask him tomorrow morning when he's here at 9 o'clock. But
that man is responsible for everything.
He is.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Go ahead.
He's a very smart man. He's actually from Colorado. So all of you who are here from Colorado know that Karl Rove actually is a product of Lakewood. You know, I think what he and others did is they basically married up the economic royalists of America with those religious fundamentalists who had a particular point of view on the issue of abortion to put together the majority that they needed in order to fulfill their quest for political power. And I think they have been very, very effective at doing so, because for the first time perhaps in history, you have the White House, the Supreme Court, the United States Senate, the United States House of Representatives, all in control of that coalition of interests.
Professor.
Well, I agree, actually, with pretty much everything that Senator Salazar and Margaret Carlson said. I'm not a defender of the Bush administration. I think their economic policies are quite bad for people in the city. I agree with that. Now, I'm less sanguine than others as a scholar on the raising of minimum wage. One of the unspoken costs, I believe in raising minimum wage, and since I believe in giving people money, and I do, I believe the way you solve poverty is you give poor people money, and then they're not poor. I have a very strong, long-standing view. You know, the problem here, here's some money, and that's how you solve it. But I'm an old 60s lefty, so you can ignore that. But here's the thing about raising the minimum wage. The studies, the econometric studies are very clear. If you raise the minimum wage, you increase the dropout rate, especially among black youth, because kids can't make the long-term, short-term trade-off we all want them to make. We know it's ridiculous to say, I'm getting an extra $1.50 an hour, I'm going to quit and work at McDonald's instead of staying in school and getting my degree. But kids can't make that trade-off easily. Their minds don't work that way. They see they're going to get an extra $50 a week if they work a full week over what they would have gotten otherwise, and so the dropout rate goes up. So there is a cost to raising the minimum wage. It's not, I'm in favor of it, but it's not as though it's costless for the people we're trying to help. Along that line, that when I say it doesn't make a difference, economic policy is not the whole world. My wife and I have spent a lot of time over the years, and I want to make this whole thing a seminar about African America. We spent a lot of time over the years volunteering with people in the inner city. One thing that's perfectly clear about these people is lots and lots of them, deeply religious folks, many of them, although in the second and third generations of poverty, some of them aren't. One of the things, for example, that people in the inner city support very strongly, as we all know, is vouchers. I used to be against them adamantly until my years of volunteer work with people in the inner city actually turned me in favor of them. What's really interesting is the number of inner city mothers I've found, speaking of black people voting Democratic, who think the reason they don't have vouchers is the Republicans are in the White House, and if the Democrats win, then they'll get school vouchers and be able to send their kids to private school. I found a lot of people who actually believe that. I'm looking forward to, I know the Democrats want to go out and disabuse them of that error in their thinking. My point is that there's a mix of things that we need. There's a lot of money that's going to have to be spent to try to clean up what's going on in the inner cities, and the Republicans are going to be against that. But there's also things we're going to need, like strong support for pro-marriage programs, which is one of the things that really, they are very crystal clear that children in the inner city who have a father and a mother married together at home have a much better chance of success, worlds better, than those who don't. Policies like that, which the Republicans are going to support, they also need. What I would love to see is a candidate who's going to mix these things together. I think that the evidence of the persistence of poverty over the decades is that when you do one of these and not the other, it's not going to work. So if you do only the economic side, you don't help. If you do only the social and moral side, it's not going to help. Until you have a way, a civil dialogue, as the senator was saying, in which we can actually take the best from various ideas instead of thinking about the various coalitions and interest groups that will oppose various ideas, take the best of them and make that our first commitment of American politics, we might be able to do something about it. But when I said that it doesn't make a difference, that as much as I admire people like Senator Salazar, people like Senator Obama, and there are a lot of people in the Republican camp I admire as well, who are really concerned people who want to do a lot of things, when you look at the way parties are structured, when you look at the interest group structure of parties, the list of things you have to go through and be adamant about and really take care of first before you can get to these seemingly intractable issues of race and poverty is a long list, and it takes a long time to do. And what people always say when I have this conversation with people in back rooms, as I do a lot, is we'll get to that after we've done A and B and C. That's what Democrats say, that's what Republicans say, and I've been doing this for 20 years. And it's a different list, you know, of things we've got to do first, but there's always three or four things we've got to do first.
Doug Shawn wants to talk.
Yeah, let me agree with you 100% and make a slightly different point. It is undeniable that one of the core values that the American people find that has been torn asunder is civility, collegiality, decency, and the ability to reach across the partisan divide in a bipartisan way to do precisely what Professor Carter is talking about. Because he's absolutely right. There is not only a Democratic way to solve problems or a Republican way to solve problems. And it may well be that school vouchers, the earned income tax credit, raising the minimum wage, and pro-marriage policies to encourage poor whites and poor blacks to strengthen their familial bonds will all work to achieve the desired goal.
I'm voting for you.
Well, I'm not running.
He's not running.
I would suggest that what the American people, and it was in the poll I presented 3 or 4 days ago, but it's larger than one poll or, frankly, one commentator. We have a system that is, to your title of yesterday's thing, that is in the public's mind irrevocably broken. And the reason the Karl Roves of the world have the success they do is that they're able to play on fears, divisions, hostilities that certainly do exist when there are larger scale desires, aspirations, and hopes that I know Senator Salazar not only has spoken to, but used to win an election that was extraordinarily difficult to win, that ultimately offers, I think, the hope for American politics.
Carl, I want you to pick up on that, but I also want to circle back to something you said in your opening remarks, which was you used the term God talk, which caught my ear because it seems to suggest something inauthentic. It's people talking God rather than being godlike,
well,
I suppose.
I'm glad you brought that up then. I did not mean it that way. It was just a shorthand. I just meant conversation in which presidents talk about their faith and their view of God. That's all I meant by it.
Well, the reason I'm bringing it up is because a lot of people are suspicious of God talk.
I'm not, and if I'm so idealistic I came across as cynical, I apologize. can I say one thing? There's no Republican on this panel that I can see. And I'm not a Republican, but I'm a reporter, and I want to bring out a couple of facts just about this spending issue, because these things are worth saying. Head Start went over the billion-dollar mark when George H.W. Bush was president. The Head Start people sort of sent up their dream proposal and got it. They got the money for every kid that they could serve. The Department of Education, in 1980, you may remember, Ronald Reagan ran against it. He said he was going to abolish it. Jimmy Carter had said, as a promise to the elephant in the room here in this discussion, the teachers' union had said he would start it. He did. Of course, Reagan didn't abolish it. In fact, he increased the spending of it. And that department and federal spending on education has increased steadily since that time in 25 years through Republicans president, Democratic and Republican. Congress is Democratic and Republican. And it increased most the current president. Do you remember the last year during the debates, during the campaign, all these candidates would make these wild charges, and the Annenberg School had this wonderful thing. They would check the facts, and they were never right about anything that they said. They weren't right about their opponent. They weren't right about their own programs.
That was just ineptitude, not venality.
His middle initial wasn't really W. They didn't get anything. But my favorite error was Bush on education, because he actually understated the amount he'd increased on education, which was striking, because you thought, these poor people can't even get something like that right. But anyway, and last night, President Clinton, albeit grudgingly, admitted that the current president had spent vastly more money on AIDS in Africa in 5 years than he did in eight. So let's set the record straight. It's not all or nothing here. Let's not exaggerate. I'm not saying a Democratic Congress and a Democratic president wouldn't spend a little more or do some of these things, but let's be fair about this.
Bush has spent more money on every single
thing. That's absolutely right. And that's why the economic right is mad at him. So I just thought we should say that.
I want to one more time around the panel with another question. Then there are microphones here and here, and I want to take questions from the audience. But Senator Salazar made an interesting point. He talked about the word opportunity and about opportunity as a moral issue. That's a word which both parties, all parties, have seized on. Republicans say opportunity is a kind of a bootstrap issue, and Democrats say opportunity is something which is best aided by government help, lubrication. How is opportunity, in your thinking, a moral issue? Margaret.
Well, you know, getting back to how Republicans frame things, and let me apologize to Jerry Rafshoon, who's in the audience, because Jimmy Carter did talk about religion and public life and very well. I tend to think, though, that Republican candidates talk about values and religion during a campaign better than Democrats talk about it during a campaign. Then when Democrats become president, as all presidents do, they say God bless America 100 times. It was only George Bush who found that Jesus Christ was his favorite philosopher in the last campaign, and John Kerry, who was going to be excommunicated.
It was the first campaign he said that.
Jesus Christ, and John Kerry was going to be excommunicated in this last one by the bishops. Republicans define opportunity as if you give something to somebody, it's a free ride, that you have to do it on your own, that the work hard, play by the rules is you do it the way I did it. Look at businessmen, look at how people have climbed the ladder. Democrats think you need a hand up, and then it comes to be seen as, you're supporting the welfare queen. Thank goodness Clinton did welfare reform to try to get back to the point that Democrats believe in work as much as Republicans do, and that is not a handout to give somebody, say, benefits for income tax credits so they end up making a living that can support a family of four, even if they're on a minimum wage.
Senator, can you pick up on the point that you made?
Yeah, I'd say you have to marry up opportunity and responsibility, and I think that's the reality, at least in my life and in the public service that I try to advocate for. I see opportunity that this country has given to me that was not given to the generations that came before me. Even though I was, I'm 12th generation New Mexican and Coloradan, I'm the first of my family to go to college, and all eight of the children in my family graduated from college, all eight of them, and that was because America really has stood up with this proposition starting back in the days of FDR and forward, saying that we are going to be a land of opportunity for everybody, no matter what your background is. And I mean, if people were to look at my family when I was growing up, we didn't have electricity, we didn't have telephone, parents hadn't gone to college, we spoke Spanish only at home, they would have said, these people are not going to make it through high school, and yet we were able to do the things that we've been able to do. And so when I look at the concept of opportunity for me, on the one hand, I think that government does serve a very important function in terms of being an enabler to make sure that everybody, no matter who you are, no matter what your background is, does have an opportunity to realize, and I'll say it, to realize their God-given potential. But I think that's important for government to do. I also think that it's very important to make sure that part of what people do is to have responsibility for themselves, and that's when you get into a whole host of other values that I think are truly American values that are very important. It's the value of hard work. It's the value of respecting our elders. It's the value of respecting young people. It's the value of respecting our planet, our land, and our water. All those values are there, and that's part of the responsibility part of the equation.
Professor?
Thank you. Well, I actually agree with Senator Salazar and also with with what Margaret Carlson said, with one tiny point about welfare reform, which I actually urged President Clinton to veto it. But I
mean, He did, twice.
Well, I understand, but in the end, you see, that the problem is, but that's because, I told you my views, give people money, you know, and you don't stop giving them money, you keep giving them money. So that's, but that's, you know, that'll, everyone says that'll bankrupt us and that'll be the welfare queen, as you say, and so on. I'm sure there's symbolic reasons why you've got to do it, but I didn't think it was a very good idea. I do believe in America as the land of opportunity. I make that very clear, and I take my wife as an example. My wife is a first-generation West Indian immigrant who was raised here by an aunt who couldn't read, who literally scrubbed toilets to put together her tuition to go to Catholic school, and then she wanted to become a Phi Beta Kappa graduate of Barnard College and went to Yale Law School. And so many families have a story like that, if not in this generation, then in the generation before, the generation before. And that's a wonderful, wonderful thing about America. Everybody wants to come here. There are more immigrants, here we're speaking only of legal immigrants, but still, we are more immigrants to the United States than the rest of the world combined. As if you look at all the people immigrate to all the countries in the world combined and add them up, it's fewer than the people immigrate to the United States every year. It's a remarkable, remarkable fact. It's it's plain that it's viewed this way. But, of course, they're right. There are things we have to do to make sure that we enhance those opportunities. A lot of what government does, anti-discrimination laws, things like that, is on the side of trying to get rid of barriers that may keep people from realizing the opportunities. But there's also, as Mark Carlson said, there's the hand up that people need. That can take many forms. That's part of my point. And so for some people, it's a check to buy food for their kids. For some people, it's a voucher to get housing. For some people, I think it's a voucher to get school. That is to say that there are a lot of different kinds of opportunities that we ought to be thinking of creating to help people continue to move up and move ahead. America can be very good to me. I've had a lot of wonderful, wonderful opportunities. Look at me sitting here on this stage, a skinny black kid who grew up in, well, not skinny anymore, who grew up in Harlem. And it's not a perfect country. It's a country that makes a lot of mistakes. Democrats and Republicans alike make a lot of mistakes. Presidents make mistakes. America's done a lot of things I don't like, a lot of things probably you don't like, but also a lot of things I applaud. And this is true also across the spectrum. There are Democratic programs I applaud, Republican programs I applaud. There are wonderful ideas. I think most people genuinely have their hearts in the right place and want to help. What's needed, I think, and this is what everyone on the panel has emphasized, is the ability to reach across our political differences and try to have a genuine dialogue, which we're not looking for the scapegoat. We're not trying to decide whose fault it is so we can blame someone and demonize them. We're really trying to see who has a good idea, what does it take to keep the American dream going, and how can we work together across whatever other differences we may have to make that a reality for as many people as possible.
Carl?
Well, I agree with that. In fact, found it very moving. I would only add to it one thing, and correct me if I'm wrong about this, but I think every successful national candidate in my lifetime has spoken about opportunity and immigrants in this way. People like Tom Tancredo do not get elected president, and that's a good thing. We welcome immigrants, but we also understand that if the government's going to give people opportunity, there's got to be some. It's a contract. There's some responsibility there. So Bill Clinton, all the successful ones have talked about it, just the way the senator did and the way Stephen did, and it's no accident because that's where we are.
Let me.
Am I wrong?
No, I don't think you're wrong. In fact, I think everybody here has achieved enough of a consensus that I'm going to try to answer question Gwen a little bit of a different way. In addition to needing a consensus to address problems, I think the problems themselves are fundamentally changing that the American people are addressing. And I think when you have the question of retirement, health care, education, and child care being of such enormous problems to middle, lower middle, and even some upper middle income people, to just try to get organized that which we have taken for granted in this land of opportunity, it strikes me that the politicians not only will have to come up with different solutions to those problems, but they will have to do it across the divide if we're going to make a meaningful difference in addressing problems that arguably I don't think are being discussed in any form by our leaders.
Okay, we will go to your questions starting here.
Two things. I have a quick comment and then a question. First, I think...
And before we take questions, I'm going to let you get away with a quick comment, but quick.
Okay. Well, go ahead. I'm concerned because nobody there responded to the comment that George Bush is the most ecumenical president yet, which I think is naive when what concerns most of us is that he has allowed his fundamentalist theology to inform his domestic and foreign policy, as evidenced by
Condoleezza Rice, who was recently wildly cheered at the Southern Baptist Convention when she said, "We're in Iraq because we're spreading religious liberty." And George Bush, who in his State of the Union in 2002 said, "We will prevail against the axis of evil because, quote, there is power, power, wonder-working power." The speech written by Michael Gerson, which, as a fallen Baptist, I knew was code to every fundamentalist in the country, because the Baptist hymn is, "There's power, power, wonder-working power in the blood of the Lamb."
I recognize that, too.
That's
my comment.
Your question? I just think no one addressed that.
That's fine. What's your question?
My question is this. If, indeed, Democrats begin to speak in the words of values, as Mr. Shun was talking, would you agree that that may make a difference to the religious moderates in the country, but that as to a majority of fundamentalists and some Catholics, it may really not make a difference because it's not values that have driven that their doctrine nearly as much as sex for the last 50 years? Are they really talking about the issues that Jesus talked about, or are they primarily talking and concerned about sex?
I think you're right. It as your question suggests, it does matter to religious moderates. But second, I believe that Democrats can win enough evangelicals if they talk in the framework that Professor Carter was talking about, real concerns about issues relating to morality and sex and children and family. I think we can reach evangelicals. Look, we're not going to get every right-wing Christian vote. I don't think we can or will. But I'll tell you one story, practical story, that ultimately, you know, could well make a difference. In the year 1996, I was, for lack of a better word, the Clinton-Gore campaign manager in Tennessee. The only spots that we ran that had any great resonance were ads that were speaking in values terms about family, religion, morality, getting tough on crime, forcing kids to account for their behavior, getting tough on people who took advantage of the system. We put Christian ministers on TV and radio, and we inundated the state. Bill Clinton won Tennessee. Al Gore lost Tennessee in 2000. If Al Gore had won Tennessee, he'd be president today. I would make the argument that if Democrats spoke in those terms, thought in those terms, talked style and substance along the lines that we have largely agreed today, we would have a result that I think most of us, and certainly you, would be more pleased with.
Can I just...
Sure.
I understand the spirit of what your question is asked, but I have to dispute part of what seems to me to be underlying it. Apart from the use of the word fundamentalism, which you've used and Mark Carlson and others have used, which I don't think that most evangelical voters, even on the right, are fundamentalists. I do think that most evangelical voters who are black are fundamentalists. I mean, fundamentalism has a particular resonance. But I think it would have to be fair about what led to the upsurge of evangelical activity in politics. Remember, as recently as 1962, Gerald Falwell, who is a fundamentalist, was preaching the traditional fundamentalist message that you shouldn't vote, you shouldn't get involved in the world. It was only after the school prayer decisions that he began slowly to change his view, and more rapidly after Roe versus Wade. But then what happened is a lot of people, and this is a lot it's largely evangelical voters, but not entirely, trying to build a moral world for their children of a particular kind, and it's not all about sex, it's about a lot of things, believe that they could do that in a way where the world would not impinge on them. Roger Williams' metaphor of the garden in the wilderness. They thought they could stay in the garden, the wilderness to the outside, the wall of separation, which traditionally was supposed to protect the church from the world. And they realized it was impossible. They realized over time they couldn't build that wall. The world was going to come in and impinge. And they've been searching, I think, through a couple of generations now for how to fight back. Can they still rebuild the wall, which some people still want to do and run away? Do they have to get in politics and rebuild the wilderness instead? I think that's what a lot of the activism is about.
Question.
Doug, in the poll that the Aspen Institute asked you to get to for this festival, the first thing you mentioned is that a good part of the populace thinks the American dream is gone. So I'd like you to maybe amplify that and then ask the six of you how we can restore for that portion of the populace the American dream.
Okay, all six don't have to talk about it. We'll be here all day, but Doug, you can start.
Sure. Well, let me answer briefly because I've already spoken to the question. I think that 90% said that 25 years ago they could achieve the American dream, which is work hard, play by the rules, and get ahead. Today, 50% said that that still was true. 50% said it isn't true. It really goes back to the point I made before about a whole new set of issues being on the horizon, people feeling that the politicians don't have a set of solutions to address them, and feeling that the system itself doesn't offer really a voice for their concerns to be heard, leading to frustration and discussions like this.
Senator, would you like to answer his question about how what we do about that?
I think it goes back to creating a government, and I'm talking Democrat and Republican and whoever else might be involved, that really responds to the issues and concerns of the people. The moral issues maybe are one set of issues at my point of view, but there are a whole host of other issues that I think are going totally unaddressed. I mean, when I look at the issue of healthcare, and I think, what is it that the people in my state think about when they put their feet on the carpet off their bed every morning? Most of them are probably thinking about whether or not they have health insurance or health insurance is going to cover their children. Almost a quarter of the people here in Colorado today don't have health insurance at all. And yet there's no discussion about those important issues. And I guess I would say that what we need to do is to move beyond some of the political debate and paralysis that we see in our nation's leadership to a point where we are developing effective solutions to the major problems that we're facing, whether those are issues like energy or issues like healthcare or issues like education, and also tackling some of these more difficult issues that we ought to be talking about, like the issue of abortion. I'll give you one quick example. You know, for me, this issue of energy and what's happening in our country cuts across so many things. It's national security. It's our future in our economy here at home. It's about the environment and global warming. We have this wonderful coalition. We call ourselves, it's a gang of energy independents. There are probably 25 senators. Conservatives like Sam Brownback and Jeff Sessions are part of that. Democrats, Joel Lieberman, myself, Evan Bayh, there's 25 of us. We know what we need to do on energy independence at the national level. And yet somehow, and it befuddles my mind, that we can't get the national leadership together to move forward in an aggressive way to resolve this issue that is so important to America today. So I think we need to do a lot better than what we're doing now.
Thank you. Another question.
Well, I really enjoyed the panel. I agree that Democrats should be talking in the way of values. One concern that I have, though, is the issue of trust. I mean, going back to Reagan endorsing the moral majority in his candidacy through today, there's been a real relationship built up, and you see that in the mega churches and their relationship with the Republican Party. And the Democrats don't have that relationship. There's been a lot to break down trust, even since the Clinton years, with what are perceived to be activist judges. My question is, even if Democrats put out those values, how do they build the trust? Because my own belief is that if they were to talk about the same issues in the same way, there just wouldn't be the same level of belief among, especially in evangelical community, that they really are getting at faith. And so when they try it, it seems like it goes on hollow ears quite a lot. And is there a way that we build trust in particular, in addition to talking about values as well?
Margaret, I would just rephrase his word from trust to credibility.
Right. Well, there are no real party organizations, and you have the mega churches being a huge force in America where people come for a lot of things, including religion. It's their social center, the gym is there, their kids go to after school programs. It's very powerful. Democrats don't have that network. And the debate, to go back to what Senator Salazar says, that we hear that's taking place in the Congress is not about what the American dream or what we care about. The last couple of weeks, you'd think the gay flag burners singing the national anthem in Spanish were the biggest problem that we had.
Only if they're married gay flag burners.
Right. So there's the way we elect people in this country is that people on the extremes get elected, and there aren't that many people in the middle. And I think, Doug, you did a poll recently which showed that there's a hunger for someone in the middle to believe in, and that the times might be ripe for an independent candidate.
But
no
Doug,
offense to my well, Democratic Doug, senator here. There are fewer of you than there are Rick Santorums in the Senate.
But Doug, isn't it? Don't we always say that? We wish we could find someone in the great middle, that it's all shades of gray, and yet when the people who populate the great middle, at least in Washington, are the ones who are most beleaguered right now.
Well, I'd say a couple of things. First, I think the hunger in the electorate for the kind of solutions that Ken Salazar was talking about, bipartisan, innovative solutions are very, very strong. I think Margaret is right that there is a hunger for new faces, new people, new ideas to come into the system. The problem, Gwen, I think, is the party system and the way Washington works. It is very, very difficult for new, not only ideas, but certainly new parties to develop, so that, to my way of thinking, there is a greater receptivity in the populace to what Senator Salazar and Margaret Carlson are talking about than there is practical ability to achieve those goals within the confines of the current system.
Next question.
Thank you. Thanks to all of you for this wonderful panel. I work for the Aspen Institute looking at how the U.S. public perceives foreign policy issues, so I've got to take this opportunity to ask you to think a little bit about that. We've heard from Secretary Powell and many of our foreign guests that the U.S. shouldn't worry, that it retains the high ground, the moral high ground internationally. But I wonder how much our foreign policy is driven by fear. Fear among the public, fear among policymakers themselves, and how much by other values, some of which you've been talking about today. I'd love to hear your comments on it.
Carl, you can answer that. I'm not sure I've heard people say we shouldn't worry. I thought I've heard almost the opposite, but maybe we're hearing different conversations.
Well, I'd like to say this.
Are you correcting him, General Powell?
Let me correct for the record, since I can do so. General Powell did not say we should not worry, but he did say.
He said we should not despair.
We should not. Thank you for clearing that up.
I appreciate the correction.
We shouldn't be weeping in the closet, but go
well,
ahead.
That reminds me of an exchange that General Powell had. I don't remember where it was. It could have been in London, but a student who was from Norway asked General, aren't we the great Satan? And he responded with some passion, no, we're the great protector. And he gave his famous line about we fought all these wars, and all we ever asked, we didn't want land or empire or territory or money. All we asked was enough land to bury our dead. Is that a pretty good paraphrase? And I want to talk about that. The woman who spoke first said that she was, I inferred that she was alarmed by Condoleezza Rice getting applause for saying we're going to war to spread religious liberty, but it wouldn't alarm me, and I think it's part of our heritage. There's a lot of reasons we go to war. One of them is we're attacked. And then another is the commander-in-chief, you know, the president says we're going to war, and he's commander-in-chief, the military follows him, and then we want to support the military, and then we're there. But there's a thread throughout American history, starting with the Revolutionary War, through to this war, and I was not in favor of this war, but one of the reasons we fight is human rights, and it's a big one, and it's what the troops are told they're fighting for, and it's what they believe. And one thread of American history is constantly extending human rights to those who do not have them, starting with the Revolutionary War and then the Civil War, and every once in a while we get in a thing like remember the Maine, and we don't remember the Maine, and a month after that we thought, did William Randolph Hearst lead us to war? But normally, that's not why we go to war. And you have these presidents who, everybody in this room, I imagine, has heard President Bush say we have no quarrel with Saddam Hussein, with the Iraqi people, we have a quarrel with Saddam Hussein. His father said the same thing. There may be somebody in the audience old enough to remember that Neville Chamberlain said the same thing about the Germans. And I know there's no one in the audience who knows that Woodrow Wilson said the exact same thing about the Germans, word for word, substitute Iraqis for Germans. One of the reasons this country fights is to extend what Jefferson called the ball of freedom around the world. And we have to ask our leaders if they're doing the right thing. But we don't need to question that motivation in ourselves. We have this thing. And if we think other people are entitled to it, I would argue that that's a noble sentiment. It doesn't justify every war, but we want to be careful about disparaging that impulse in Americans. That's how I would answer that.
Just a very small point to answer the question directly. Lost my microphone. No, I don't think that this war or other wars are fought out of fear. I happened to oppose this war when it began, but I think that what's characterized American foreign policy, an area in which I teach over the years, has been we do diplomacy out of realism and we fight wars out of idealism. And I think that we may fight over the ideals. we may argue, I don't buy so-and-so's ideals about things worth fighting for. And that's an important public argument to have, but I don't think we should ever think that presidents send troops into war casually, unthinkingly, to satisfy some constituency or to keep people from cowering under their beds. I think that presidents tend to be driven by very high motives, even if they're motives we may disagree with, or they may be motives we like. I don't know. We may like the motives and disagree with the strategy. We disagree with the motives. But I think it tends to be out of idealism, and I think it's been true all through our history.
Next question.
So Ken Salazar and others, including Margaret Carlson, have observed that the votes of the evangelical right or the values voters have been co-opted by a very narrow set of wedge issues like gay marriage, flag burning, and so on. And so one solution for that is that has already been proposed is that the Democratic candidates must also actually expand that pool of value issues. But the question sort of I'm asking is, so that's sort of the political solution on the Democratic side is to expand the definition of what these values are. But on the other hand, doesn't some responsibility lie with church leadership and individuals living in America, so individual Christians who spend a couple of hours every week, say on Sunday mornings, going to church, and do they not reflect that their pool of values includes more than these wedge issues? Do the church leaders not realize that part of their job in preaching and conveying sort of ideas about religion are to explain that the set of values in the Bible include a lot more than issues about gay marriage? And have we absconded? Has the public and church leadership sort of absconded on that duty?
I think your question, we can take this on, but I do think it assumes that there is just one message that's being preached from every pulpit in America and that there's some monolithic message that's coming from American churches. Senator?
Can I take that just quickly and using an example of the great immigration debate that this country is embroiled in today? I would say to you and the audience here that I believe that the faith community, led by the Catholic Church, has been probably the greatest advocate for a human values-based comprehensive reform here that would address all aspects of the issue that confronts this country today. And I've been very pleased, frankly, by the kind of leadership that has been shown from the pulpit all across the country. It has been telling to me in some ways that there have been some key elements of the faith community that have been missing from this debate, including some key elements of the evangelical right, who are housed right here in Colorado. You know, when I look at this issue, you know, I recognize the sovereignty issues of the United States and our national security issues and the importance of us as a nation of the rule of law to enforce our rule of law. But as Senator McCain, from his very beginning conversation with me on this issue almost a year and a half ago, said we ought not to forget the moral and the human issues that are involved. First time I met with Senator McCain on this issue, almost 18, I was a brand new minted U.S. senator in about a week and a half. He and I had a meeting in his office. He had a newspaper in his hand. He threw it out, put it on the table, and he said, Ken, he says, I want you to look at this. He says, I want you to look at this, he says. The Arizona Republic, headline in the Arizona Republic, over 400 people die in the Arizona desert. He said, anywhere in America where you'd have 400 people who would be dying in these conditions in order to pursue the American dream, you would have people standing up and saying there's something wrong, there's something immoral, and we need to do something more about it. Well, I think there are significant segments of the evangelical community who have been dreadfully, in my opinion, silent on this issue, which beckons all of us to come up with some kind of a comprehensive and humane solution.
Gwen, let me just say one thing. I referred to fundamentalists, which I was just looking for a shorthand term. You used Christian right. Whatever it is, the active religious voters been animated by what they don't like. Gays, teaching evolution, school prayer, or they're for school prayer, abortion, they're against stem cell funds. Not by what they're for, necessarily. And that's what I think you're getting at, which is what's the way to get to what we're all for instead of what this group is against and which has actually gotten very much into our policy during the Bush administration, especially, I'd say, the stem cell funding and the pro-abstinence. I wouldn't say they're pro-marriage policies as much as they're pro-abstinence policies that have come in under the Bush administration.
Next question.
I think the conversation has been great, Gwen. I want to thank Carl for pointing out that out of six members of a panel on politics and values, there's not one Republican. I think that was a very good thing to point out. Let me say, I have been disturbed in Doug's, listening to Doug and talking about values, and I think you're onto something. I think it's very important. I have been disturbed in Washington on the relationship between values and consequences or results. And we had the panel talk a lot about Head Start. And certainly the idea of Head Start is one that really plays into values. You're helping poor kids, you know, just get up in education. The trouble is that I joined the poverty program in 1969, 70, 71. They had studies of Head Start. Finding, by Westinghouse, of all people, finding basically that there was really no lasting influence from the Head Start program. Then in the 1970s, there was a study of Head Start showing that the poverty kids, poor kids, that joined Head Start and the poor kids that did not join Head Start, the difference between them was washed out by the seventh grade. Then the Clinton administration did a bigger study, even, that found no impact of Head Start beyond grammar school. All right. Now, you have a program that everybody, Republican and Democrat, thinks stand for a value, really caring about kids. But yet you have now 30 years of solid evidence that those kind of programs really have done no good. I'm just wondering, you know, it's wonderful to have feelings. It's wonderful to have values. It's wonderful to have care. But when are we going to start looking at what works and what doesn't work?
Professor?
Well,
you're having problems with that microphone.
I'm having problems with this microphone. I'm going to do what the fellow told me to do and take my ID tag off. Well, first of all, you're right about Head Start. The data are fairly clear about that. With some minor exceptions, there's some efforts to create programs that would continue with a kind of intensive work of various kinds that may extend some of the results. But the differences do wash out, and the fact the differences wash out is evidence that a lot of the problems that I've been talking about in the inner city aren't going to be solved simply by the kind of programs that we're familiar with. That is, what happens is Head Start runs up against other data. So, for example, if your parents don't read, not just read to you, but read at all, the data suggests you're not going to do well in school. If the television's on a lot at your house, even if you're not the one watching, if you're a kid, the data are you're not going to do well in school. If you don't have two parents at home, the data are you're not going to do well in school. And we have to attack those things, too. They're not all amenable to programmatic solutions. One thing that's necessary and really important, frankly, is for a lot of individuals who otherwise would write a check or vote the right way to roll up their sleeves and get involved in the inner city with actual families on the ground and spend time with the young people and the families setting different kinds of role models, showing them different ways of living, because we tend sometimes to think if we voted for the right program, we've solved the problem. So I agree with you. But the second point about that, even though there are sometimes programs that don't work or have problems, my father, as some of you in this room know, was intimately involved with the early years of AFDC and certain other programs when they expanded massively in the Johnson administration. One thing he likes to say is that, of course, it's true. It was true then, and it's true now. We have a lot of data about some of the costs of those programs. That is, there were things that happened that shouldn't have happened. There were things that went wrong. But we can't forget there were also people starving before we had those programs, you see. There were actually people starving to death in the United States that we don't have anymore. And so sometimes the well-meaning program can solve an immediate problem. We just can't lose track of it then. We can't assume that now we're going to stop and we've done that and we'll go on to some other thing. Instead, we've got to go back and revisit them and improve them constantly.
When there's one other thing about Head Start, which is that what these kids were getting in Head Start was not as good as what they were getting when they got into the public schools. And what you need to do is to supplement the public schools or make them better, that so that what's happening to these kids when they're 3 and 4 years old continues. Not that Head Start was a failure, but that the public schools are a failure.
Another question.
Hi, my name is Laura McCluskey. I'm a doctoral student at Stanford School of Education. And I was also a teacher for 7 years, and we had a character education program at our public school. This is the case at many other public schools now. And I'm wondering what your opinion is of character education in the schools, and if there should be a set of core American values that are taught within our schools.
Once we agree what they are, yeah. Who wants to take
Who
that on?
Who can be against character education? I'm for it.
Yeah, exactly. That's the problem, though, the definition. What is character education? What are American values? And how do you teach that without getting a fight?
Can I just say, for example, we taught empathy in our school. You know, we taught independence, some things that, you know, maybe people would have differing opinions on.
Let me ask Professor Carter a question. I read about a month ago on this lady's point about character and values in the African-American community, Professor Orlando Patterson's piece in the Sunday, New York Times op-ed page. I'd be curious your reaction to that in the context of values.
I'd rather answer the question.
All right, well, Professor Patterson spoke of the value, the issue of values of African-Americans and the interposition or the impact of those values on programs and lifestyle choices. And the reason I thought to raise that was I thought Professor Carter might well offer not only a comment on your question, but something that would speak to something that he's addressed for most of the panel
today.
Well,
the reason that's why I didn't want to answer that's why I'm going to answer the other question, because it is a fact, of course, that a lot of programs, including Head Start, one of the barriers they run up against in the African-American community is the culture of the inner city and the cultural problems of the inner city. Which we're all familiar with, even if you don't live there, just by driving through, a lot of the behavioral and other issues are huge intractable problems. I'm just saying they're not unsolvable, but people have to actually roll up their sleeves and want to go in and solve them, as opposed to, I think I can pay somebody to solve that. That's not going to do it. On the issue of character education programs tend to be treated very cynically by students unless they believe, and I've been involved with some of the character education things over the years, unless they believe that the adults in the community are on board. That is, unless they believe this is a value that their own parents and their teachers are actually modeling in their lives, oh, by just another hour or week you've got to spend in the class, and would you rather be out running the streets or doing something else. So, again, it's a matter of the rest of us making commitments to, if there are things that we think are the values of America, whatever our differences about them would be, if there are things that we think are the values that make America great, then we've got to model them in our lives, and that's how we'll teach them to kids.
Question. I'm Melanie Sturm from Aspen, Colorado, and my question has to do with how best to convey good values to the children who are most in need of it, and I'd like to address my question to Professor Carter. I found your story, your wife's story, and your brutal honesty and critique of both sides to be very reflective of your deep desire to really affect change in that community. And I have felt for a while that there are a couple of things that I think could potentially be effective, and I'd like your comment on it. And I say this as a Jew. I actually feel that teaching Christian values to children so that they have Christian values is better than their having no values at all, that they are better off knowing thou shalt not murder, thou shalt not steal, and that I know there are constitution
values.
Sorry,
no, I'm confused. I thought that was the
Judeo-Christian values.
That's her point.
I'm sorry.
Judeo-Christian
values.
But the whole notion of separation of church and state and not teaching these values to children is an issue in America, and I would rather kids have those values than no values at all. But the second part of the question is having iconic cultural heroes like Bill Cosby, who really speak truth to the population and who tell it like it is, why aren't more black iconic figures doing exactly that? And would that be effective?
Well, that I'll be very brief. I'll let other people on the panel talk. That's not a black-white problem. That's not a black community problem. The iconic figures for young people generally today are people whom I suspect, in terms of what they stand for, relatively few people in this room, whatever their political stripe, probably admire. I mean, if you think of the people young people celebrate in the celebrity culture, the things that many of them stand for and the way that they stand for them are in many cases not what we'd want our children to emulate, and that's true of poor black parents and well-to-do white parents both.
Anybody else?
Wasn't Bill Cosby condemned for what he said about the culture of the inner city and the black teenagers? What did you think of it?
Oh, I thought he was largely right, but I think he, I don't want to labor the point, he chose a conversational style that maybe wasn't the ideal way to get the point across. This goes back to the civility issue we talked about. He was clearly bitter and angry about what had happened in his community, and he let the bitterness and the anger seep into his comments, as maybe I did at the beginning of this panel day, for example, and that's not always the best way to get your point across.
Senator. I want to just respond on the values question, because it seems to me that one of the points that is missing here is the role that parents play in making sure that their children have good values in our society. You know, I happen to have been very familiar with the bloodiest school shooting in America, Columbine, which happened here in this state. And yet, though these were not African-American children, they were not Hispanic children, they were not children of lower income backgrounds, these were children of two parents, both of them fully intact families, father and mother, and yet these two young men decided from some root of evil. I had two wonderful parents that taught us through the hardest of times to do what we've been able to do, but I still struggled in my own fatherhood of my own two daughters. I still struggle today. I have a 17-year-old, so you know a 17-year-old and an 18-year-old. You know what that's like, two daughters at home. So I still struggle, and I don't know. I think I don't know how to be the best parent I possibly can. And I think that's one thing that we ought to be doing more as an American society, is taking on the role of understanding parenthood and how best we can be parents better. Because at the end of the day, that in the family, that's where you find the great basket of values that we try to pass on to our children.
By my estimate, we have time for one more question on this side and one more question on this side. So you get the final one on this one.
Dick Kaufman from Aspen in West Michigan. I'm concerned about separation of church and state. And I believe that the greater the integration, the greater the problems that the body politic and the citizens experience. Republicans have apparently had great success in utilizing the institution of the church and belief and faith in the service of their party.
Good question.
My question is, I'm hearing, let me just say one more thing. I'm hearing the panel from a Democratic point of view thinking how they can enlist these same institutions and the same things in the service of the Democratic Party. And I'm wondering if the panel thinks that church and state can still be separated with the greater use of these institutions in the political process.
Carl?
Well, I want to defer, but I would say that, what did you say your first name was? I'm sorry.
Dick.
Dick. He represents a huge wing of the Democratic Party, 40-50%. Secular people who are worried, who don't want the Democratic Party to just be Republican light, don't want to imitate them, and are worried about it. And I don't have the answer for you, but I would add this, if you're Democrats, further complicating your lives. The trick for the Democratic Party is they need to get these Tennessee voters who want to know about values, they need to keep all these voters.
That's exactly right.
It's a tough thing to do. And I respect what you're saying, because you speak for a lot of people.
That is true.
Doug, you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think that the questioner is raising a central issue. I agree completely with Carl. I think you can talk in values terms. I think you can embrace issues like prayer and its role in the schools without stepping over the line. It's a very, very difficult challenge, as the Supreme Court decisions on the Ten Commandments would suggest. But I think you can do it. I think that Bill Clinton was able to bridge the gap during his administration, not only talking in values terms, but in actually doing things that integrated faith into life and public policy. And I guess, to me, Carl's ultimately right. If the Democrats can do it, they can return to being something close to the majority party in the United States. If they don't, we will be doomed to deal with races like Ken Salazar's, where we're swimming upstream and we look at him as the exception rather than the rule.
Reverend Land, you get the final question.
Well, I'm one of those Southern Baptists that wildly applauded Condoleezza Rice. She got 12 standing ovations. One of them was when she said, "Do you realize if I serve out my full term, it will have been 12 years since a white male was Secretary of State?" And she got a 1 minute standing ovation from the Southern Baptist Convention.
It's funny, we didn't hear so much about that, did we?
Well, that's why I'm leading to my question. Yeah. She also got a minute and a half standing ovation asking people to please quit when she said that slavery didn't end with the Civil War and that her administration was committed to the international fight against new forms of slavery until it was abolished everywhere in the world. And I'm sorry, Senator Salazar, that you don't know. It's probably our fault and probably the media's fault as well. The Southern Baptist Convention, which is the largest Protestant denomination and is overwhelmingly evangelical, has taken a stand very similar to the president's, that there has to be a comprehensive addressing of the immigration question, and that we have to expect the government to enforce the law, but we also, as Christians, have to reach out to meet the physical, emotional, and spiritual needs of people who are here illegally and to try to give them a pathway to becoming legal.
Now,
and
if I don't ask you to get right to the question, everyone will say I'm being unfair.
So has the NAE.
Yeah.
My question is, how do we get the media to quit having the most extreme views on the right and the most extreme views on the left on shouting matches, and instead of having people who have a far more contextual view of these issues and are more in the middle? I mean, there are people who are center right and center left that, like me, on hundreds of occasions in the infamous pre-interview have been weeded out because we won't make the kind of extreme statements that far too many in the media want
like
to hear.
Margaret, why is that?
Well, I always think of my friend Michael Kinsley when he hosted Crossfire telling me that the producer kept saying in his ear, "Get angry, get angry." You'd have to shut down cable TV and the floor of the United States Congress because I'm afraid that's whom we've elected and that's where the ratings are.
Anybody else on the panel want to take that on?
Are we about wrapping up, Gwen?
No, I would like for you to answer his question.
I'm not in favor of it. I'm just describing it.
I felt, you know, this is the test. Reverend, let me just explain to you that there are studies at the Annenberg School on what people will watch on television. People will fill out the polls and questionnaires the right way. Oh, I want more stories in education. I want nuanced. What do they watch? They watch these arguments, and in fact, they wire up their brains and they watch them more intently. And so what you're asking for would be good for the country, and I shouldn't surprise you as a religious figure. It's also contrary to human nature. So the test that you're asking for, it's not a small thing.
I understand, but the media has a responsibility for the public's airwaves.
We have a responsibility to stay in business, too.
Well, speaking for public television, I would say that, yes, we do have that responsibility, and what has happened with the media over the last 10 or 20 years is that we have become so broad. There are so many little slices, and people are so selective. They go to Fox to watch what they want to know. They go to CNN to watch what they want to know. They want someone to confirm their pre-opinion, what their preconceptions are. And as a result, we in the media and as the media have failed, I think, in trying to get those shades of gray into the debate because, you're right, it doesn't always work for the format. But that will allow me to bring me back to the final question for the panel, which is because I do think that the media has a unique and special role in all of this, which is how do we, not just politicians, not just preachers, not just talking heads, how do we find a way to infuse our public debates with more discussion of values that don't just fall into the predictable, expected discussions?
Doug.
Not all at once.
I think there are three challenges. First, I think we have to encourage politicians to do what Ken Salazar spoke of, which is bipartisan, cross-partisan solutions and approaches to issues. Second, Gwen, and I think I can say it to you as somebody who does this for a living, we need to encourage the media to listen less to me, pollsters, ideologues, advocates, talking heads.
That could be arranged.
I know. That's the easiest part of the panel. But fundamentally, we need to encourage what Reverend Land was talking of in the media, and we need to insist on it. And public television does it, but we need more of it, because I think it can get decent ratings if there be the moral imperative to achieve it. And the third thing we need to do is I think we need to have the elites in this country demand it in the way that your question did. In, unless we force the issue, it is just not going to get raised.
Carl,
well,
everybody
be okay. We need to be fair, and we need to put our biases aside. And there was a beautiful story. I'll leave you this one image because I can't get out of my head. Bush goes around this country justifying the Iraq War by saying, you know, I meet with Koizumi, and my dad fought against him. You've all heard this. And, you know, 40 years from now, the president of a free Iraq will be talking with the president of the United States and we'll be solving world problems. And Koizumi always, he's a little bit, he puts up with that. But the other day he went to Graceland. He loves Elvis, Koizumi. And he met, but before he went to Graceland, and we didn't write about this, he stopped at Walter Reed. President Bush goes to Walter Reed all the time. He does everything to do to discourage coverage. And Koizumi found a soldier who was from the South and who loved Elvis, and Koizumi loves Elvis, and they sang the Elvis version of the Battle Hymn of the Republic together. And if that is not the most wonderful image, but I don't think we covered it.
No, you just said they do all they can to discourage coverage, and then they say we don't cover
no,
it.
No, I mean,
I don't know how you.
Well,
but do that.
This was in a pool report, I guess. But I mean, we need to be skeptical of. We need to be skeptical of bad news as much as we are good
I
news.
Agree.
Well, I actually have a substantive suggestion, aside from letting Gwen Ifill and Morgan Carlson moderate all the talk shows would probably make a difference. But I have another substantive suggestion, which came actually from a retired New York Times reporter who told me that when he was coming along in the 60s as a new reporter, that they thought their job was to explain what was happening. And by the time he retired, their job was to say what people were saying about what was happening. If the media sees its job more as let's tell you what's going on, let's tell you a story, let's explain these in detail, as opposed to let's put some heads on the screen to tell you what they think about it, I think it's doing a much better job. And it's never an excuse to say you've got to stay in business. I know you're being facetious, because the media has the First Amendment. If all you're doing is giving people what they want, I mean, cereal manufacturers and car manufacturers don't have no concept of protection, give people what they want. So if all the media's going to do is give people what they want to see, you don't need a First Amendment to protect that. You just need a capitalist system where you already have that.
Well, I would just say that I think for all of us it's important to recognize that our values values that continue to change over time and to get better. And I think it's important to remember also how far we have come along as an American public. You know, when I look a lot at our world and our values through what happened through civil rights and the 14th Amendment and the Civil War, you know, some 20, 30 years ago, no one would have thought that Barack Obama is an African-American, myself as the only Mexican-American ever elected outside of New Mexico would be sitting in the U.S. Senate. We never have thought that Condoleezza Rice and Colin Powell would serve as Secretary of State. So our values have evolved from a point in time in America where we allowed for one group of people to own another group of people just simply on the basis of their race or their color, to the 100 years of segregation after the Civil War and Brown versus the Board of Education, to more an era of inclusiveness. And I think one of the things that we need to do is to recognize how wonderful of a country we are and how much progress we have made. Sure, there are lots of problems that we still need to tackle, but I think there's a fundamental set of values here that continue to evolve to help us, in my own mind, realize the God-given potential in all human beings. I would finally just say this, that I think one of the horrible things that happens in this country is that those of us in leadership often don't set a very good example on good values. When we end up demonizing those who happen to disagree with us instead of engaging in a discourse and a dialogue and a recognition of tolerance of somebody who disagrees with us, I think we do a disservice to creating the kind of dialogue and civility that we were talking about here. And I hope that we can do that more in the future so that we can encourage these kinds of values to be passed on to our children.
Margaret.
Well, on a cynical note, I think as long as Ann Coulter's number one on the New York Times bestseller list and Bill O'Reilly has the highest rated talk show, we've got a problem getting the dialogue back to where we want it to be. But on a positive note, as long as we have Ken Salazar and Barack Obama and Senator Collins and the Gang of 14 trying to find a middle ground, there's hope.
On that hopeful note, we'll leave it. Thank you all very much.